1, 2, 3.
Hello and welcome back to the Mix of Music Podcast. I'm your host, DK, and with me as always is my lovely co-host, Lostless Lou.
I have not lost a thing yet.
Hear that HD high quality Lostless Lou.
Big shout out to Pre-Mastered Voice.
What was that Instagram account? Profit Mixing.
Oh, Profit Mixing.
Profit Mixing. Shout out to him for sending us a long list of
options
of Lou nicknames. We have a few other people as well from Discord that contributed some nicknames for Lou. I think there was a few. Thank you for reaching out. Let me find this list real quick from OK Baby Music. And OK Baby Music did a bunch on Discord.
Damn, I need to get back on Discord. I haven't installed Discord on my new phone, and I'm looking at a list of like 20 of them from one person.
Yeah, there's a lot. So appreciate all the love. So today we're going with Lostless Lou. Thank you so much for reaching out for that. But today's episode is an interesting one. We're taking ideas and snippets from other episodes, meaning that we've touched on this topic before, but today we're going a little bit deeper into it. And this is going to be an interesting episode because I want to talk about genre cultures.
Oh, yeah.
So mixing cultures between genres, as well as Lou wants to get into a little bit of how to use reference tracks.
Yeah, listening for tonalities.
Yeah, so I think that this is something that Lou and I talk about a lot, and this is something that I make a big deal of when I do my Monday night live streams where I'm either mixing a song or doing some feedback. Monday nights on my Twitch, you can go to links.dkmixes.com to go to my Twitch, or twitch.tv/dkmixes, D-E-K-E-I, mixes. I talk a lot about tonalities and genre cultures and intention, which goes into intention. Like, if you intend your music to sound like an era mix, like an era record, like you want it to sound Michael Jackson, that's going to drastically affect the general tonality of the mix, even with the same instrumentation as something else. So, like,
absolutely.
We're going to talk about genre cultures here. And this idea came to me from the first time that I ever heard this was at Mixed with the Masters with Leslie. And he talked about the culture of trap music and the current trends of pop music in general. And he talked about that quite often, showing that this is something that he studies and that he picks up on with new songs and new trends in the music industry. As right now, you've seen a lot of UK drill that's happening in the hip-hop scene right now. There's lots of different trends that happen over the course of time. And then there are artists. So most independent artists try to follow trends. And even if they say, I'm not really trying to follow a trend, I think it's pretty obvious that everybody's influenced by somebody and follows trends.
If you're downloading a YouTube type beat, that argument is null and void.
Yeah, so, yeah, downloading YouTube type beats, which is not bad, right? So I think it's kind of like the argument of, just briefly, this is a tangent here, but the argument of Donda versus CLB by Drake, where...
Two completely different albums.
Let's look at their shoes, right? So this is an idea. I met someone, an artist named Jimmy, at this event that Bob Horn was hosting this last week, and we hit it off really well. Like, he was an artist, like a visual artist, and he talked about how we were talking a little bit about the dispute between these two albums, and I brought up the idea of there's two types of artists. There's one artist that is very consistent and makes really good music. And then there's the other type of artist that makes new waves. Very creative, very groundbreaking, and a lot of people follow in that direction. I mean, I said Kanye was very groundbreaking and new, and Drake was just Drake. It's really great. And he described it in a couple different words. He said about Drake, he said, you can tell by the way they make their shoes. They have their shoes, right? So Drake with Nike. Nike uses the same exact silhouettes, just in different colorways, trying to get people on. But the one thing that it is absolutely reliable. On the other hand, Yeezys, where they're a little bit more weird and groundbreaking shoe designs, different shoe designs. And then he says But you don't wear Yeezys every day. You wear your Nikes most days. It's very reliable. So there's a need for both sides. It's not one side is better than the other. So I'm not saying that we don't want to say follow trends, but we want you to at least be aware of trends, whether you're breaking them or following them.
You might be too young for this, but do you remember 50 Cent versus Kanye?
Not fully.
There was like if I'm remembering this right, but from what I remember, they both released an album the same day or relatively close to the same day as each other, and whoever was victorious would continue doing music and the other person would retire, was essentially the running bet. Now, the funny thing is, you could say the same thing about 50 Cent versus Kanye. 50 Cent wasn't necessarily groundbreaking. He was just really good for that time, but once his time was out, he's out. It's not like he continued. Kanye continued creating his own sound.
Yeah, so either way, regardless of whichever type of artist you are or producer you are, oftentimes producers have to do both. They have to be able to be groundbreaking, but they also have to be able to follow trends. This is a very common thing. We need, even at a very high label level, it's not very uncommon to hear, like, we need a BTS-type record.
Oh, yeah, all the time.
We need a, you know, and with your own spin on it. So let's talk about genre cultures as far as mixing.
Sure.
The one thing that I always bring up, and I think this is funny, in trap music, Alex Toumey kind of coined that snares and hi-hats are loud. You know, I mean, it's a culture thing, but he kind of like said it out loud, at least as far as I know, and kind of made it a thing before all the younger generations. So like the people on the come up. So they started like, even Nels is very much influenced by Alex Toumey saying that. So hi-hats and snares are loud and trap music, very, very loud. Do you know what other artist or genre is loud hi-hats? It's Stevie Wonder. Stevie Wonder's hi-hats are so damn loud.
But that's the groove. That's actually what's pushing the music.
There you go. So,
Same thing for trap.
Exactly. What are some mixing? I mean, and we talk about this too. Like in rock music, it's less bass and less treble and more mid range.
Yep.
Where trap music
and vocals tend to be more in the mix versus on top of the mix.
Yeah, as well, and then pop music, depending if it's a vocalist, then usually the vocals are on top a little bit more.
Yep.
If it's a very large production, it might be a little bit more mid scoop, just a touch. But not as much as trap music. Trap music is very mid-scooped.
Sometimes a little harsh.
Yeah, and this is incredible. Yeah, in hip-hop music, vocals, in trap music specifically, vocals are very bright. And for some reason, there's this trend of absolutely no low end.
Yeah, I've noticed that when I had to mix trap records for clients, I'll reference different people. But the funny thing is, I tend to roll off around like 200 hertz sometimes, and then I'll actually make up for that low end by adding some like low mid saturation to actually get a little more of that presence back in the low mids. But outside of that, like there tends to be nothing under like 180.
Yeah, and I think that trap, this is an opinion that might upset some people, but I'd like to have this conversation. I'd like to have this conversation. I'm open-minded to be different here, but
open your ears.
I do not think the current generation of trap mixing, most of these big, big records, I would say is not a very good example of good mixing.
You know, I'll say this, like there's a lot of artists that branched out of trap. Correct me if I'm wrong, because I could totally be wrong on this. You know, I'm not a huge trap guy, but Young Thug came from trap, basically, right?
Well,
like
I mean,
around
yeah.
that kind of sound. But he's more kind of pop sounding nowadays in that same lane, though. But his mixing has gotten significantly better. They've gotten him sounding very, very smooth and everything. But that's not characteristic of trap itself.
Yeah, I would say that kind of trap was this cool revolution in the industry where low budget, get the most out of the least, you know, and it kind of changed the mixing game a little bit. I feel like because of trap music and the rise of popularity of trap music, engineering standards and expectations went down significantly.
Yeah, that's where for me, I wasn't really into it because every time I did hear a production and they're like, wow, this sounds amazing. And I'm Like, sitting there listening to it, I'm like, am I that far out of tune with the culture right now?
So, and I have a couple of reasons why. One is, within a genre, usually the types of mixes are not that different within a culture. With trap music, sometimes people get very dark, and sometimes people get money on the grave, just absolutely hissy, destroying your eardrums, like type mixes.
Oh yeah.
And so it's way too diverse. It doesn't feel intentional. It doesn't feel like anybody's doing it with purpose in mind, in the most part. Now, there are really great mixers within the trap world, but I think that part of the reason why expectation has gone down is not because it's become so much more accessible, and many of the big records that got big were just so low quality.
Mm-hmm.
I think it's also partially because of the nature of trap music. Trap music has the most minimum instrumentation. I mean, mixing trap music is so easy because it is almost impossible to get a vocal to clash with the instrumentation of a trap beat. There's too few elements.
Unless the sample itself is clashing, but even then, not that hard to correct. It's just a single sample.
And most of the time
in
trap music, the sample is the quietest part.
Yeah.
You know, so, and because of that, then it opens it up into, it's just so much easier that the expectation has gotten lower. Now, obviously, most people can appreciate a really good mix. Money on the Grave by Drake and Rick Ross is definitely not it, not even close. It's one of my least favorite mixes I've ever heard in my life. And you've always wondered why it sounds like your brain is going to squeeze out of your ears when you listen to that mix. I'm confirming that. I'm confirming that it is harsh as crap. But that goes, this is a whole nother topic, but that goes to show the importance of making an artist big, coming up with an artist.
Now, I think going into the whole, how to reference the tracks, because a lot of people will ask, like, you know, what's a good record to reference? And the reality is, it's all taste, you know? It's the same way, it's like, which mac and cheese is better out the box? It's like, I don't know, what you got available, you know? But if I had to pull up like records to reference and everything, I'm not necessarily looking for a specific artist sound, but rather something that stood out for me. And a lot of trap music, like if the hi-hats are loud and the snare is hitting hard as shit and that kick and 808 are nice and clear, I'm probably going to reference that because way too much trap is harsh, at least on their hi-hats. I've heard a lot of big records where like the hi-hats start playing and I just want to turn down the volume. I don't exactly want people listening to my mixes and having that experience of wanting to turn it down. I want them to be able to turn it up. So funny enough, like, that's what I was saying, where like Young Thug's recent productions, they're not really that harsh or anything. Actually, they're still bright, they're still crispy, but they're not annoying.
Can I make the argument that out of all the people that show us mixes, and this is, here, follow my thought process here.
Following.
But the reason why genre cultures is important is that from a producer's standpoint, to be groundbreaking and different is incredible. From an artist's standpoint, it can be very beneficial. But from a mixer's standpoint, it is almost completely inappropriate. Because if I listen to your song, let's say it's a Lil Durk type beat, right? And the mix is wildly different than anything else within that region, right? It's really dark and there's no low end, so it's mixed like a rock record. Then I will never give a chance to your song. I won't be able to listen to the song even as a consumer. I'm not talking about a mixer. Of course a mixer's going to pick it up, but I'm saying we've all have friends that we've shown them our records and they said they couldn't listen to it. They obviously couldn't take the time to listen to it because it didn't sound right. Something was a little bit too different, so it took away the opportunity for a casual listener to appreciate the record.
And the funny thing is, like, that's extremely true because, my fiance doesn't do anything that we do in our industry. So I sometimes like to just listen to what she says about songs she's listening to or watch how she goes through Spotify or Tidal because we have both. So, like, seeing how she skips songs, what is it that she's like, oh, she heard something. And that caught her attention, you know, almost as if it was like a consumer review watching it. the funny thing is, you could tell that some of the songs she would stop on are either songs she's already familiar with, because she can tell by the tone, or she'll hear something that is similar to what she already listens to, and then stop on that song, give it about 5 seconds, and be like, I don't know, and then skip. And part of that is, like, familiar tones. And we were talking about that when reference mixing would, you know, are we listening for something that's completely different from what we're used to? Not always. Sometimes we're just in a mood and want to listen to records that are within the same lane. If you're a groundbreaking artist and you're going for a completely different sound, that actually may be working against you if you're too far off the map.
Exactly. Now, I would say that almost, because there are records out there that the mix and it being bad, for example, XXX is one of them. Tentacion, or whatever the hell his name is, released really distorted records.
Yeah.
That blew up the internet. Like, that was an example. But that, I would say that that's not mixing, that's production.
Yeah.
A creative move like that, like, mixing is creative only to a certain degree. And, like, as a producer, it's your call to distort the entire track. As a mixer, if you distort the entire track, you're immediately fired. Like, you know, so so I would say that although mixing is a creative field because it is within the realm of recorded audio and of music, it is very important to remember to, as a mixer, it's important to watch the trends and to a certain degree be an analyst as part of your job, an analyst, and to work on records in a way that are trending to allow the music to be given a chance by its listener.
Oh, yeah. Like, have you ever, I know this has happened to me. You're working on a project. They say, oh, I really love the way the mix sounds on so-and-so's record. You listen to the record and it's not even close to the lane of what they're doing. But at that point, you're not even listening to the tone. You're listening to the relationship, how it actually sounds. Like, it may just be that they have less reverb.
Yeah.
It may just be that their reverb is maybe plentiful, but they have a lot more pre-delay going on.
That happens all the time when artists send me reference tracks, and I'm sure many people listening right now, as well as you, Lou, have gotten this. I get a list of 3 to 5 reference songs, and every single one of them
sounds completely different. Yep. I always tell people, like, let me know which reference songs and why you chose that song. Just give me, like, 1 or 2 sentences, if you could, just so I know what I'm looking for specifically.
Now, I don't want to discredit the artist and say that they don't know what's going on. They're oblivious to everything. But I do want to say that it's also part of our jobs to interpret what our clients want,
the
producer or the artist. So if they send 5 songs and they all sound totally different, there's something that's related to all 5 of them. Some sort of spot the sameness in between everything, right?
You could say it could be the energy behind the lead. Like, the lead sounds powerful in all these.
Yeah, it could be like the general volume of the lead vocal. It could be how it's compressed. It could be the tonal balance. It could be how loud the guitar is. Exactly. It could be how deep the 808 is. It could be like it's so many different things. It could be how annoying that hi-hat is. They just really like really annoyingly loud hi-hats.
At that point.
But it's our job to interpret.
Yeah.
And to make it within the realm of accessible. It is our job as mixers to make music accessible to appreciators, to listeners, to fans. Yeah. And, I mean, I guess that's everybody's job other than the artist.
Yeah.
But I think that more so for mixing. Like, a bad mix will make me talk shit about you for the rest of your life. I'm just kidding. That's
I mean, I heard what you said about my masters. Jeez.
No, I know, but I mean, like, it's a bad mix will.
I always say it like this: a bad mix can change the trajectory of the actual end result that you were looking for in a record, creatively speaking. Like, if your mix was supposed to sound lo-fi, like a trap record typically tends to, then you got to communicate that. But if we make it sound amazing and clear, like Britney Spears quality mix, Justin Timberlake quality mix, as a trap record, and that's not what you were after, no matter what we say about it being better, it's not what you wanted at the end of the day.
Have you had this experience too, where like a very good, renowned mixer of pop genre has a mix that's very good technically, within the pop realm. Mm-hmm. But it just doesn't sound as grimy or right for the song. Sometimes the griminess is good.
Yeah, so I've actually recently had that where I receive the, because I do a lot of stem mastering for people, I receive the stems to a record firsthand listen to it, I'm like, I hear the mix that they were after, but there's certain elements that need to change in order for it to really bring it home. But, you know, this mixer is great mixer on all other songs that I've heard from them, but it was because it was a different genre that it's like, ah, I hear the style of mixing was for a different genre than the one that's presented in front of us. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
Yeah.
So I think that this is all encompasses just to at least be conscious of the tonalities of your music. Also, from Lou and I's vast experience of listening to people's mixes, it is very, very blatantly obvious when you do not reference when you mix.
Yeah.
Referencing is because you are so far off the field of what we can tell you intended to deliver that it's just like, yo, this is you just losing which way was up. You thought you were diving, you thought you were climbing to the surface of the water while scuba diving, but you were actually just going deeper into the ocean. Like this is, it's very obvious when that happens. So we need to, it is important for you, especially as a beginner, to take constant breaks.
Oh yeah.
Or even this is for everybody, even advanced up to advanced level, take breaks often, reset, and reference. Just even if it's just a moment, I don't think you have to rely too heavily. If you reference too heavy, it'll start hurting your ego. You know,
even when you think you got something good, just walk away for a little bit. We did this earlier, DK. I showed you a song I was mastering, came back to it. I'm like, you know what? There's a little bit too much upper mids and highs, and it was literally like a 1 decibel difference.
Yeah.
But literally, even when I thought I was like, oh yeah, it sounds great, coming back to it, I was like,
And I think a healthy amount of referencing is not the entire time. In the sense that, like, I have a reference track. Mm-hmm. What I'm doing is I'm referencing back and I'm listening to the reference track every time that I question a move. For example, I don't know how loud the 808 is supposed to be compared to the kick drum, but the reference track will tell me what they were going for. Yep. And I might decide to veer away, but I'm going to listen to the reference track so I can keep the vibe. One, keep the vibe.
Yep.
And two, have a reference of good sound. A reference. Absolutely. The reference would be a demo track, like their demo recording, as well as a track that I think is well mixed of something else completely.
Oh, yeah.
There's two types of references, right? So the demo track, and then you use that to try to keep the vibe and not change it too drastically. And the second reference would be, this is a really well-mixed song with great tonality. And if my vocals doesn't sound even close to that, if my vocals are obviously much brighter or darker than this one, then you're probably off. It's supposed to kind of give you, you know, the center of balance again and figure out what your range of acceptability is as far as mixes go.
And that's kind of the funny thing, because if you were to look at, like, how... for instance, if I'm mastering a record, I'll ask somebody, send me your mastered version. Like, because realistically, I want to hear what you guys thought was amazing before sending it to me. Like, because obviously you kind of held on to it. So demoitis is a thing. Your clients may have it. And because of that, if you're referencing only tracks that are out on the radio right now, but you're not referencing what they originally intended, then you might be going a little too far left, even if it does sound better, because it may not hold the same feel.
There you go.
And feel is a thing that's not necessarily tonal. It's not necessarily a specific frequency content. It's literally the vibe of the record. And referencing, sometimes we forget to check the vibe.
The last thing that I will say is practical critical listening versus non-practical critical listening. Mm-hmm. For example, Bob is like the king of all the little tricks. Bob Horn, who we've done an interview with on previous episodes, amazing mixing engineer. He has an entire full, like a lot of these small little tips and tricks to help improve the sound of your mixes.
Some of them are just weird technical little things.
Like, for example, leaving tonal balance control on your mix bus will slightly change the tone of the song.
Yep.
Or the first version of Saturn by FabFilter, if you leave it bypass but keep the HQ, the high quality on, the way that the plugin may have been coded, will keep the HQ and the upsample on even if the plugin is bypassed.
That's on the first gen only?
First gen Saturn only. And then the second thing he talks about is the importance of the metering. So pre-fader metering versus post-fader metering has a different sound in Pro Tools. And this has been confirmed by like avid Pro Tools people. Like, yeah, this is a thing. People have discovered it. It's very, very subtle. Like half the subtlety of a converter. And I would argue that it might be partly in people's heads, you know? But I would say those are non-practical critical listening. Those things do not make or break a mix, and those smallest of nuances will not turn a record that sounds bad into something that sounds good.
Yep.
And a record that sounds good may not change into something that sounds better, relatively speaking. It may or may not.
In fact, it might actually cause it to veer left a little.
There you go. So I think, and then there's practical listening, which is not as deep. You don't need to hear what dithering is. Okay, you don't need to hear your upsampling on the plugins. Like that is less practical and more broad sweeps.
Mm-hmm.
I'm hearing the mid-range being a little bit more forward in this one.
Tonal balance control, bringing that one back, using the little filter listening on it.
And not bypassing it, but I mean like literally using the interface.
Because what is it? Option click on the UI for it.
Yeah, so I think it's like Alt if you're on Windows, Option if you're on Mac.
Yeah, and then that clicking thing, on it. I use that all the time just to make sure that like frequencies aren't clashing with each other in ranges. That'd be practical. But bypassing it to see if tonal balance is doing something that makes or breaks your mix, it's not.
And
guys,
that's why people like pay Bob his rate, is because he is a freak about this stuff. And I think there's something to say about that.
Yeah.
And I will not discredit Bob in every single way. He is absolutely amazing. He has some of the best ears in the industry.
Oh, yeah.
But I don't think that knowing that someone else can do that and knowing that you have to be able to do, I don't think you have to be able to do that to put out world-renowned mixes. I think that that is would only help, but is not necessary in the slightest. So I do believe that nothing that we're talking about is within the realm of inaccessible and has to be highly trained. I think this is more in the realm of common sense, easily accessible, just the time. Take the time to reference. The time to notice. And then use your ears and train your ears to pick up on different things. Focus on the low end. Focus on the low mids. Focus on the mids. Focus on the upper mids. Focus on the highs. Focus on the S's. And notice like when you reference, you're not like pick up on specific details rather than like focusing on the general thing. I think that's the best way to kind of train your ears to pick up the differences, the subtle differences, and to practically use a reference track better. Like at first, if you're not really hearing difference, or if you're not like, just listen for specific characters. Listen to the guitar and the guitar tone.
Yeah.
Listen for the kick drum. Like listen for specific things, and then over time, you'll be able to widen that vision. Your peripherals will start to go deeper and deeper and deeper, wider, and slowly. In a slight glance, a playback a song, just 3 seconds, you'll be able to tell everything that what's right and what's wrong. Be able to use that practically. So this is like a no pressure type thing. Like I don't think you have to try too hard, but this is something that you should take the time and put in the effort.
Yeah, just don't overthink it.
There you go. At the end of the day, also don't overthink it. All right, so I think that's a lot of information. I think that's good enough for what's going on. If you have any questions, hit us up on Instagram at DK Mixes, DEEKEI Mixes, and at
Midside Sound.
Midside Sound for Lou. If you want some feedback, every Monday night, again, I'm on my Twitch. I have Discord as well. You can go to mixingmusicpodcast.com and go to you can find the Twitch, find the Discord to get in. You'll also find a coupon from our sponsor, iZotope. iZotope is one of our favorite plugin companies. They're absolutely amazing. If you go to iZotope.com/MMPodcast, you can get 10% off of your next online order Or you can get your first month free of your music production bundle, your monthly bundle from them. iZotope is an absolutely amazing company. We love them. Tonal Balance Control that we were talking about during episode is an iZotope product, and it's totally worth it. So
I mean, Ozone alone.
So you can go to mixingmusicpodcast.com and then go click on sponsors to find iZotope link, or you can go to iZotope.com/mmpodcast. So thank you so much for listening. We appreciate everyone. Happy mixing, my friends, and stay saucy.
1, 2, 3.